Chances are, you've heard the story of Beowulf. It's a great story about a hero who comes to save a king whose hall is being savaged by a terrible monster called Grendel. Beowulf defeats Grendel, only to discover his mother, Grendel's mother that is an even worse monster. But then Beowulf defeats her too, and then years later he has to battle a terrible dragon, and although he wins, he's mortally wounded and dies. Oh dear, I forgot to say spoiler alert. Well, anyway, Beowulf's a great story. An epic tale held in historical reverence as one of the earliest Anglo-Saxon works of literature. Oh, and it's also important because some young Earth creationists believe that it tells the true story of men fighting dinosaurs in Europe. Stick around. It gets verse.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Dr. Karen Stolzno and Ben Radford, we talk about monsters, folklore, and the facts behind these stories. I've got a couple announcements to make before we get into our interview. First, this weekend is SciCon, the second annual Skeptics Conference held by the Committee for Skeptical Inquirer. CSI, formerly SciCop, is the organization that was founded many years ago by some very famous skeptical thinkers, including James Randi, Ray Hyman, and Paul Kurtz. Sadly, Paul Kurtz passed away just a few days before this recording, but his work will live long into the future thanks to his many writings and the many people who he influenced who continue to publicly respond to clear nonsense and to seriously inquire into mysteries with rational thought and skeptical methodology. I assume that the SciCon event will not be a place to mourn his passing, but to celebrate his work, and I and Ben Radford will be there this weekend in Nashville if you want to come say hello. The second announcement is a bit of monster news about me. I have a new short story appearing in the next issue of Weird Tales magazine. It's a humorous story in the vein of H.P. Lovecraft, and I'm delighted that my first pro fiction tale is in the same venerable magazine that gave Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard their starts. I hope you'll look for it at your local magazine outlet or online. It's issue number 360, and you can also get it at WeirdTalesMagazine.com. Thanks.
Monster Talk.
If you're a regular listener to this show, you know we value skepticism and scientific thinking. I personally am very interested in many aspects of the human condition, including biology, neurology, psychology, sociology, and others. And while I won't cite any particular statistics, it's safe to say that a very large and vocal percentage of our country does not believe in evolution. In some ways, this doesn't bother me. I know enough about the mechanisms behind the brain's belief system to know that people who believe this sort of thing are unlikely to be persuaded to another way of thinking except through their own journey of discovery, and that nothing I can say here is going to change their beliefs. If you want to believe the Earth is 6,000 years old, that's fine. Just like as an IT professional, I know that a large percentage of the people I help with computer problems think that computers are magic. They don't understand how they work, and they're not interested in learning more about them. They know just enough to get by and are satisfied. Of course, computers aren't magic, and the world isn't 6,000 years old. And not only is evolution a fact, but it's been demonstrated again and again that it happens, that natural selection is the main mechanism driving it, that predictions based on evolutionary theory are backed up by molecular and geological findings, which are truly astonishing, and I get it. I'm okay if you don't believe that. But the problem I have is when people of faith try to put their creation myths into the science classroom. That's a serious problem, and if you care about that issue, I would urge you to support the National Center for Science Education, the NCSE, which works to keep that issue under control. I'm also bothered when people stretch the truth or lie to create works which less inquisitive people then use to prop up their faith. I've always felt that if you have to make up lies to support your beliefs, there's probably something wrong with your beliefs. You need an example? How about serious claims that the monsters in the old English poem Beowulf were real and were in fact dinosaurs? Oh, if that sounds like a joke, it isn't. In this episode, we're going to interview skeptical humanities researcher Eve Siebert about her work on just such a claim.
Monster Talk.
Hey, today we're talking to Eve Siebert, formerly of the Atlanta Skeptics. I assume you're an English major. Could you just tell us what your background is?
Yeah.
Way to kill time there.
Yeah.
There,
good job. On the other hand, I have read your article.
That's good.
Yeah. So.
Well, I have a PhD in English literature with a concentration on Old English and Middle English and Old Norse.
Well, that probably comes in great at parties too, right? We're going to talk to you about a paper that you've written. Where is this going to be published?
Skeptical Inquirer.
Excellent. All right. Ben, do you know when that'll hit press?
Given the lag time and the amount of backlog we have, I couldn't tell you when it'll be slated. I'm guessing it'll probably be mid next year.
Okay. So this will give some people something to savor as they wait by their mailbox.
Yeah, sadly.
I liked it, though. It was a good article. So for those of our listeners, so let's sort of set the context. Mm-hmm. For those people who may not have read or watched or ever heard of Beowulf, mm-hmm. Can you sort of give us a summary of Beowulf?
Well, Beowulf is an old English poem, though it's set entirely in Scandinavia. It's about a hero who faces several monsters and kills them. One is called Grendel. Then there's Grendel's mother. And finally, a dragon who Beowulf actually ends up dying in the fight with the dragon. The dragon also dies.
But I think people should have had time to read this, right? When was it written?
Well, that's highly controversial, but probably between the mid-8th century and around the beginning of the 11th century.
So people should have had time to look at this by now. Okay, so
yeah.
Okay, we'll just leave.
It's been on Kindle for at least a couple weeks.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it's something we're all forced to read in school. I can't remember too much of it, but back in high school, we were forced to read it.
I seem to remember a whole lot of consonants. Is that right?
Yeah, consonants and vowels.
Oh,
both?
Excellent. Well, most of the translation, it had extra consonants.
So what's the historical significance of this tale?
It's the earliest Germanic epic, part of the earliest Germanic literature that survived. As far as being actually historical, it's not. There's a historical background to it, but, you know, it's sort of semi-history, legendary.
It's also appeared in quite a few adaptations. Again, I remember reading it when I was, I don't know, probably in middle school, then again in high school. And then I think a couple of years back, there was a movie version with Angelina Jolie, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
How historically accurate was that?
Well, how accurate as to the poem? Not terribly. Grendel's mother, not a hottie in the poem. But she always tends to be rather attractive in film versions. There's one starring Christopher Lambert. That's who it is. So there's a version. Yeah. That's
oh, my gosh. I have that on DVD and haven't watched it.
Yeah, it's not good.
Oh, hey now. That's more of a real spoiler. Well, so, okay. Your article, though, is not just about Beowulf. It actually is about I'll let you describe it more, but it's really about how young Earth creationists or creationists are trying to use Beowulf to corroborate the scriptural stories about the creation of the Earth. Is that right?
Yes. Well, mostly because, well, it has a dragon. And anything with dragons is fair game for young Earth creationists, because the argument is that stories of dragons are really about dinosaurs. And they indicate, therefore, that humans and dinosaurs coexisted, therefore, young Earth. I'm not exactly sure how that works. It seems to me there might be a few steps missing, logically.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the argument.
It's like step three is profit, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the dragon makes Beowulf quite popular for young Earth creationists. And a few have gone even beyond that, with the other monsters also being dinosaurs.
Well, right.
And so, sometimes dragons.
Yeah. So what are they mapping these creatures? That's a fair way to say that they're basically mapping these fictional or poetic creatures or legendary creatures to real historical creatures that don't really match the timeline according to science.
Right. Exactly. And they also try to make Beowulf out to be a true story, because they read everything almost as literally as they read the Bible. So Beowulf, true story.
So and who exactly is spreading these theories?
Well, the most elaborate version is by a guy named Bill Cooper, who wrote a book called After the Flood, The Early Post-Flood History of Europe Traced Back to Noah. And he says that, you know, it's a true story. Beowulf really existed. He was born in 495 AD, around tea time. And he really fought dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs. Sort of like Land of the Lost. Right. And as I recall, there's one particular case, if I'm remembering it correctly, the author was trying not to actually specifically identify it as a T-Rex, but it was clear mm-hmm. from the context that that's exactly what he's talking about. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, well, this is the battle with Grendel, who's the best known of the monsters in Beowulf, the one who actually has a name. And he argues, well, definitely that it's a dinosaur. And through mistranslating the poem and misrepresenting it, he makes it appear that Grendel is actually a young Tyrannosaurus Rex with small arms, because Beowulf is actually able to tear off one of Grendel's arms, therefore it must be small and weak. Of course, the poem says nothing of the sort.
What can you give us? I don't know if you have it right in front of you, but can you give us a little bit of a comparison between, you know, what the original says, again, either paraphrased or quoted, mm-hmm. and what they're saying?
Well, the original says, it's clear that Grendel and his mother are basically human shaped. They're referred to as in the shape of a man and in the shape of a woman, except that Grendel is larger than any other man. Cooper quotes a translation that just leaves out the word other, saying, so it says that Grendel is larger than any man. So by leaving out the single word other, which is there in the original, he transforms basically human-like creatures, large human-like creatures, into just bipeds. And then it's through the fact that Beowulf tears off Grendel's arm that he makes the assumption that, oh, therefore his arm must have been small and weak. But in fact, what happens in the battle is both combatants are extremely strong. Grendel is determined to get away from Beowulf. Beowulf is determined not to let Grendel get away. And in the struggle, Grendel's arm is torn off. So it's actually the combined strength of Beowulf and Grendel that leads to the injury. It's not because he has wee little T-Rex arms.
It seemed like, as I read your article and looked at the materials that they were presenting, versus the original original intent. Mm-hmm. It seemed like there was a lot of, intellectual dishonesty? I mean, I'm not sure how to describe this, where, you know, things like leaving out a word or just selectively interpreting one particular phrase. It's basically like quote mining or something. You know,
yeah.
I'm not really sure what that's called, except it's not right.
Yeah. It's sort of cherry picking.
Cherry picking. Maybe that's what it is.
It's hard to say whether it's really dishonest or not. It seems dishonest, but it's hard to say to what extent, you know, he's deluding himself, because it's impressive the degree some people can delude themselves. Although it does seem he must realize what he's doing in some cases, that's just not accurate. Or certainly the fact that he gives the impression that he's familiar with Old English. He doesn't actually say it, but he mm-hmm. gives that impression by talking about the Old English, even quoting the Old English, even translating a little bit of it himself, which gives the impression that he actually knows the language. But he doesn't actually know the language. It's clear he doesn't actually know the language. If you actually know the language, it's clear he doesn't actually know the language. And it seems to me that's definitely dishonest, giving the impression that he has more expertise than he does. Hmm. But otherwise, it's hard to tell the degree of dishonesty versus the degree of just self-delusion.
So what is his actual background?
Well, let's see. According to the back of the book, he has a bachelor's degree from Kingston University in England. Since then, he seems to have, I just realized recently, he seems to have accumulated a couple of doctorate degrees, but I haven't been able to figure out where they come from or what they're in. But he does have, he has a BA in religion, philosophy, and political theory and English literature from Kingston University. But the English module would not have covered Old English.
Mm-hmm.
So he would not have studied it.
Do you think he had anyone else do those translations for him? Or
well, the one translation he says is his own. And, you know, it's not too far off. The gist is correct, but it's clear he doesn't know the grammar. Elsewhere, he quotes a published translation, although he doesn't always cite it properly, but he is referring to a published translation, which is unfortunately a verse translation, which takes a lot of poetic license, you know, which is fine, but not if you're talking very specifically about what words mean. And based on that, he gets a lot of things wrong.
Yeah, I was going to ask, can you sort of expand on that in terms of the differences between prose and verse translations in other languages where, you know, there may be two actual translations, but one of them has been, you know, modified and changed for very specific literary purposes?
Mm-hmm. Well, a prose translation is likely to be fairly literal. I mean, it's still not going to be absolutely literal or it wouldn't make sense. You know, they have to change word order because the language has changed to a degree that you can't have the original word order or it wouldn't make sense. But fairly literal. A verse translation has to fit its own rules of meter and so on, whatever meter or alliteration the translator is using. So a poet will make changes to the original and get the feeling of the original, the basic story of the original, and then we'll try to perhaps give a sense of what the language sounds like as much as you can. But in doing so, you know, is changing what the poem actually says a little bit more than a prose translation would. So changing parts of speech, changing words around, in a way that a prose translator wouldn't, which again is fine unless you're saying that this particular word, ithuwinets, refers to, for instance, sea monsters when actually if you look at the original, it doesn't refer to the sea monsters at all.
In the original Beowulf, are like in the version that we have. So I guess for, you know, this, correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a while since I've studied Beowulf. I was an English major too, but, you know, my recollection was these were originally spoken word tales and that this is something that was written down later by poets who were trying to preserve. I mean, I'm not sure how, you know, maybe I'm not, I don't know what their intent was, but they wrote down a poem that had been around for a while.
Possibly. We don't really know when it was written, as I said.
Yeah.
He wants to make it much older than it could possibly be, like written immediately after the events it describes, which if that's the case, it's in the wrong language.
Right.
But we don't know exactly when it was written. As I said, there's a range. So, and we don't really know if it was orally composed or if it was a literary composition. It comes from oral tradition. So in Old English, there are a few poems that we know are literary compositions, but they still have certain aspects of oral tradition in them. So it's very hard to say if this specific poem was orally composed or is a literary composition?
Roughly, there's kinning inside the poem, and kinning is it's a special kind of metaphor that's used in poetry, I guess. But in their poetry, they call the ocean, they call it whale road instead of calling it the sea, right? Which I think is really, you know, that kind of metaphor I really enjoy because it adds a richness to the story. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe that's why I always thought that it must have been based on oral tradition because it used oral tools, I guess, you know, communicative tools. That's not really a question. My question was, in the written version of the poem, they do refer to Grendel as being related to the race of Cain. And is that actually part of – I mean, I was wondering if that was part of the original story, if that was maybe added in by some scholar to an existing tale. But if there's no earlier version of the story than this written version, and we don't have any other copies of it, then I guess – it doesn't have to be a pious addition. It could just be part of the original written tale.
Yeah. Actually, Grendel is associated with the race of Cain. It's not entirely clear. It's a little ambiguous whether he's descended from the race of Cain. This is actually a point Cooper makes, that arguing that it was written before the conversion because it only mentions the flood and Cain and Abel and nothing in the Bible post flood. So he wants it to be very early, before the English converted to Christianity, and that it's an independent version of the flood and therefore corroborates the Bible. That, of course, is not true for a number of reasons. However, most scholars agree that the Christian elements in Beowulf and in a lot of Old English poems aren't just sort of superficial. That there's an argument of how Christian it is, but that, you know, it's as integral to the poem as the pagan elements. And there are both Christian and pagan elements. It's, you know, once they converted, it's not as if all of a sudden their Germanic heroism just sort of disappeared in the blink of an eye. It's sort of like, you know, you got Germanic heroism in my Christianity. You got Christianity in my German heroism. And so it's a happy mixture or unhappy mixture. So, but yeah, it is not necessarily a monkish interpolation, the references to Cain and the flood.
So have creationists attempted to reinterpret other works of fiction that you know of?
Geoffrey of Monmouth's works on the history of Britain and the prophecies of Merlin. I know Cooper thinks those are real, too. A bunch of Norse works that deal with genealogies. So at least to a certain extent, yes, that he and others do think other works of fiction are real.
Well, it struck me, you know, just sort of when I was reading that and hearing you discussing it, that there's only one several examples where creationists try to use, clearly fictional stories or even monsters to support biblical stuff. As I recall, the Cardiff Giant, part of that story was that, the guy was trying to show that a local biblical literalist was wrong. And there's a interesting strain within Bigfootery. Where people are trying to sort of, you know, recast Bigfoot as, you know, could this be, you know, the ancient, the race of giants mentioned in the Bible, things like that. And even, even Chupacabra, as I talk about in my book, you know, either the one of the Chupacabras, one found in Blanco, Texas, was purchased by a creationist museum.
Right.
And put on display as it was. It's clearly chupacabras are not mentioned in the Bible, as far as I know.
Right.
But in his mind, the idea was that if science could be proven wrong about, you know, these creatures, then what else could they be wrong about? How about evolution? It's this really, really weird, tortured logic. Go ahead.
There's a book by co-written by Kent Hovind and William J. Gibson that's creationist cryptozoology called, I believe, Claws, Jaws, and Dinosaurs. And it's the weirdest thing. They talk about Beowulf as well, which they get from Cooper, though they don't cite him. And they got Bigfoot meeting Leif Erikson.
Right.
And the weirdest things, because some of it is just like, I can't imagine, even if this were true, what it actually has to do with creationism, like dodos. Because, well, we know dodos were real, and we know dodos existed not terribly long ago. So even if you find one, how does that prove creationism?
Right.
And apparently they just sort of go to, well, the diverse wonders of God's creation. It's like, well,
in his article, how does he phrase that? I mean, what does he just leave it ambiguous, or does he just sort of, what does he say about the connection between Beowulf and the Bible?
Cooper, as I said, he says it's independent of the Bible because it was written before the English were converted. And therefore, the references to Cain and Abel and the flood corroborate the Bible. And most of the whole thing about Beowulf and the monsters is actually a tangent. The book primarily is looking at the Table of Nations in Genesis and comparing that to a bunch of genealogies, early European genealogies in Old Welsh, Old Irish, Old Norse, and Old English. And many of these genealogies mention a son of Noah somewhere. And again, he says that these were written or originally composed before these countries converted to Christianity, and therefore they corroborate the Bible, that they're independent sources for the flood. But, you know, they're not. They're all the references to Noah are pretty late. That they're like the last thing that gets added to these genealogies. And most of them, we know where they came from. Mostly it's during the reign of Alfred the Great. And then the other place, like the Norse borrowed from the English genealogies. So they're not independent of each other, much less independent of the Bible. So, as I said, he thinks they're independent corroboration of the Bible.
But in order for that to be true, it would need to be a document historically as old as the Bible, right? I mean,
it would just have to be before the English converted to Christianity or before.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So, it's tricky, isn't it? But I noticed in the story in Beowulf, there are real people's names in real places. So this is probably a true story then, right?
You would think, but no. And actually only one of the characters in Beowulf is really regarded as having been a historic person, definitely. And that's Beowulf's king, Heorot, because he's mentioned by Gregory of Tours somewhere. But no one knows anything about him except that he was killed in battle, really. And that's it. The other characters are mentioned elsewhere, but it's all in sort of semi-historical legendary stuff. So they might have existed. They might not have. It's sort of like King Arthur. Maybe he did.
What? What? Look, don't undermine my project to fund a search for the Holy Grail.
Okay. Yeah.
What is that? Kickstarter.
There you go.
So historically, was it believed to be a true story?
Well, it's hard to tell because we don't, any evidence that anyone read Beowulf until much, 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 much later. But I would suspect to some extent, certainly the background of the various wars and feuds and dynastic marriages, those would have been considered to be true. And people seem to have believed in monsters of various sorts. So quite possibly, people would have thought it was true to some degree. But on the other hand, it's a conscious, poetic work. So,
well, yeah, but people, some people think Robert E. Howard's Conan stories are true. So, you know.
Well, there you go.
Well, and this, so the piece that you read, that was essentially, it wasn't really a scholarly piece. Was it sort of quasi-academic? I mean, he certainly put on pretensions of being scholarly, but its audience, I imagine, was probably adult creationists.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it sort of has a veneer of scholarliness that, you know, the stuff he's talking about is so obscure that it seems scholarly. He has 14 appendices. That seems scholarly. He's talking about works in Latin and Old Irish and Old Welsh and Old Norse and Old English. Latin is the most accessible one, and it's the dead language. On the other hand, he doesn't have a very good bibliography. His source citations are difficult to follow, things that you would actually expect to find in a scholarly work.
But, so, no, go ahead. I was going to say...
But it seems scholarly, but it isn't. And plus, there's also a bunch of anti-intellectualism when, you know, he's talking about real scholars. He dismisses what they have to say because usually by calling them modernist.
Are there sections of it that are in all caps? Because we know that that's a sign of accuracy.
No, there are occasional uses of bold, but no, not all caps.
Well, how's the the question I was leading up to was that his writing wasn't initially geared towards children, but oftentimes, as we've all seen with creationist materials, they're aiming for the younger kids who are perhaps not as as skeptical or as wise.
Right.
How has this literalistic interpretation been presented to kids? Do you know?
Well, yeah, there have been works aimed at homeschooled children that have been inspired by this or other, you know, the dragon is a dinosaur sort of thing. So there have been some homeschooling materials, particularly there's a whole series of radio adventures called Jonathan Park. And there's one, The Hunt for Beowulf, where the Beowulf manuscript has been stolen, and the creation response team is going to find it because it has evidence that dinosaurs and humans coexisted, therefore young Earth. Of course, the poem still exists, whether the manuscript exists or not, so I'm not exactly sure why they're so keen on finding the manuscript, more keen than the British Library apparently was. So it's being presented, it's being filtered down into works aimed at children, particularly homeschooled children.
It seemed to me that with the monsters he's picked, like Map, Grindel and Grindel's mom, and then the dragon, it seems like he's picking really popular creatures from real history, like the T-Rex and pterodons.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, do you think he picked them because that's what he knew? They were the most popular? Or like, because it seems like it's a pretty far stretch that's what was really being talked about. I mean, I've seen other people interpret the Grindel as a possible Bigfoot. If you think...
Which is more plausible.
Well, exactly. So you flip a coin. Which is it? If it's not really just what they're describing, it's got to be some real creature. Is it a T-Rex or is it a Bigfoot? I wouldn't think that would ever be I can't really tell based on the words which it is. I mean, you know what I mean? Those things don't really look much alike.
Right.
So it seems odd. Why do you think he shot for T-Rex? Why pterodons? I'm going to cut most of my question out later.
Well, I'm not sure. I think partly it's because he's very ignorant about dinosaurs as well, because as I understand it, that T-Rexes have not been found in Europe. So they wouldn't fit. And Kent Hovind, in his version, actually says Megalosaurus, which are T-Rex-like, but they found Megalosaur bones in England, I think. And same with the pteranodons, that they are purely North American, so they don't really fit. And I don't know if it's because they're popular or he's just really convinced himself of this, because he, with the pteranodon, he's very specific that that's what the poem means, not any other sort of flying dinosaur-like creature. That because the poet refers to the dragon as a far flyer, that means it's a pteranodon, because they could fly farther than, say, pterodactyls. Of course, it's clearly just a poetic word, and it's there to alliterate. But again, he takes things very literally in the poem, and thinks these are zoological terms. He calls them zoological terms when they're clearly poetic terms.
And well, you make a good point in your article that if this were real, if these people had been running into T-Rexes and pteranodons, we'd probably find bones of those creatures in their burial sites.
Yeah, especially, the dragon loves treasure. He's been sitting on treasure for 300 years and been perfectly content until someone stole a cup from him, and then he goes into a rage. And that's really typical of Germanic dragons, that they love treasure. Fafnir in Sigurd or Siegfried cycle loves treasure, turns himself into a dragon to protect his treasure. There's a poem called Maxims, Old English Maxims, where it says that the dragon shall sit on treasure, which is basically a truism. That's what dragons do. They sit on treasure. So you'd think when people start unearthing Anglo-Saxon treasures or Old Norse burial ships, that they would find dinosaur bones. But strangely enough, there have not been many dinosaur bone findings around Germanic treasures.
That is curious.
Yeah, I know. Odd.
Well, I have a quick question, and this is for anyone else, even anyone else. Does anybody know, is Hoven still in prison? I know that he was sentenced to.
Yeah.
Is he still doing time? Good for him.
Yeah.
Well, it's something about you got to pay your taxes.
Yeah.
So if you don't render unto Caesar, that's which is Caesar, Caesar will render unto you a harsh sentence.
Yeah.
Stupidity is not illegal, but evading taxes is.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Eve, we have a question that we always like to ask of our guests. So could you answer this question? What's your favorite monster?
Oh, there's so many. I'm going to say dragon, just, for Beowulf.
Good choice.
You mean dinosaurs?
Yeah, I mean dinosaurs.
Right.
That's right.
Be clear about that.
Yeah.
Oh, my
Big
gosh.
Fire-breathing dinosaurs.
Yeah. How do they explain that? Science. I assume it's the flicking giant red tongue,
I don't know. He mentions that the dragon's called a fire dragon, but doesn't explain how that fits with the dinosaur.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It seems like a lot of this is a rather tortured logic, so.
Yeah.
But I thought your article was excellent, and
thank you.
I look forward to seeing it printed up with pictures and whatnot, as they do in the Skeptical Inquirer.
Oh, do you think you might do a follow-up of this article for an academic journal, maybe, to answer all of his or to counter all of his claims?
I have actually written a much longer version. I'm planning on putting it in a book I'm working on with Robert Blaskowitz about skepticism and the humanities.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. You just heard an interview with Eve Siebert about her upcoming article for Skeptical Inquirer on the surprising claim by creationists that the story of Beowulf was real and describes humans and dinosaurs living together. Hopefully all of our listeners will be able to get their jaws to undrop soon after that sinks in. Monster Talk is brought to you by Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed on this show, while totally awesome, do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. Thanks again to everyone who's been contributing to Monster Talk's transcript project. We're getting more and more episodes transcribed and uploaded every month. Here's an interesting statistic. It seems very likely that we'll cross the 1 million downloads mark very soon after this episode goes live. Watch my Twitter feed at Dr. Atlantis, and I'll post it when I see it. You can find links to mine and Karen and Ben's social media, plus our show notes, at monstertalk.org and skeptic.com. Monster Talk's theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks for listening.
Of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
Here's an interesting statistic.